So our next talk is going to be security requirements engineering by Chris Alberts. And Chris Alberts is a principal engineer in the CERT division at SEI, where he leads applied research projects in software assurance and cybersecurity. His research interests include risk analysis, security requirements engineering, measurement analysis, modeling and simulation, and assessment. And he has published 2 books and over 40 technical reports and articles. So Chris is queued up. Again, Mark is going to stay on stage with us as a facilitator to continue the conversation. But Chris, welcome. All yours.
Thanks. Okay, I'm going to talk to three topics today. I'll give some background information, talking about some of the basic concepts behind security requirements engineering. Then I'll look at the security engineering risk analysis method, or SERA. That's going to be the focus of the talk. I'm going to talk basically showing how we can better integrate risk analysis into the requirements process. And then I'll summarize with a few key points. So let's start with the background. Starting with software assurance and the definition and kind of what we think about when we talk about software assurance. Two key aspects, predictable execution, and there we're really looking at, does the software function as intended, and then trustworthiness. Are there any exploitable weaknesses in the software? And what we're trying to do is establish a level of confidence in those two key aspects. And requirements is a key piece of that. And so we're looking at, this is the lifecycle model that Mark showed just a few minutes ago, and we're looking at the very early part of the lifecycle, at defining the requirements and focusing on the early acquisition aspects of software. So let's talk about what software security requirements are. I define these as features, such as controls or constraints, that specify how to preserve the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of critical data in the system. And so you'll hear me reference CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability multiple times throughout this talk, and because that's kind of forms the goals of what we're trying to do with software security requirements.
Okay, a polling question again. Like I said, we're going to ask them multiple of these throughout the day to get an idea of who's with us in the audience, and that's going to help Chris Taylor some of his speaking points. But the question that's going to pop up now is, are you experienced in developing security requirements? And that is a simple yes or no question, and you will have that on your screen now. And we're going to go back to Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. Should I just head to the next slide?
Yeah, go ahead to the next slide, and we'll give them about 15 or 20 seconds to vote, and I'll give you results.
Okay, with software security requirements, here's some of the key activities. I'll kind of use these as kind of the anchor for the talk, and then I'll show you next where we're going to focus. Start by agreeing on definitions. You want to make sure that everyone's talking the same language. A lot of problems come about with respect to security because people often have different views of what terms mean, and often there are different variations on terminology. So when people come into a requirements situation, they may have different ideas about what things mean. You want to get everyone on the same page. Second key activity is to identify system assets and security goals. So this starts out by looking at what's the critical data that the system stores, processes, and transmits. And once you understand that, then you want to know what's important about it from a confidentiality, integrity, and availability perspective. And now you have the critical data and the security goals. The third step then is to look at the risks. And much like Chris's previous presentation, kind of what they were doing, when you think about it, is they were looking at what they knew about the system, and they were starting to think about, how can we attack it? Well, that's what you're doing in step three here. You're trying to think of how can we, based on what we know currently, remember, we're early in the life cycle, so we don't have a full picture, but we have some logical diagrams that we can look at how things are interconnected, so we can make some plausible guesses. And so you do the risk analysis, and then based on that, you decide, are there design weaknesses? And for those design weaknesses, that feeds into step four, your illicit security requirements. You build requirements for those weaknesses, and then categorize the requirements, which essentially means you map them back to the security goals that you defined. Then develop priorities, which ones are most important, which ones are least important, because there's always trade-offs, and you have to make sure that you focus on what's important to address. And then the last step is to inspect the security requirements. Here, what you want to do is to look for weaknesses or problems with the requirements and correct those flaws as early as possible.
So, Chris, to wrap up our polling question real quick, we had 57% with no, they're not experienced in developing security requirements, and 43% yes.
Okay.
So hopefully I can tailor your talk a little.
Okay. And so here's where we're going to focus in this module. We're going to look at primarily at steps two and three, looking at the identifying the assets and the goals and then performing the risk analysis. But I'll show you later on how what we do in these steps actually looks at some of the subsequent steps as well.
Chris, could you explain a little bit about where these steps came from?
Sure. There are a lot of different methods out there. I took these and derived them from a method that we developed here at the SEI called SQRE, Security Quality Requirements Engineering. And that has defines a set of steps. And I kind of took out the key steps that really focused on some of the I think the key high points that you need to look at in security requirements engineering. Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add on SQRE? Because I know you know a lot about that, too.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, some of the method and the history behind SQRE and how well it's been used in practice.
Well, SQRE is actually a fairly mature product. It's been around for more than a decade, and it's been developed. Nancy Mead was the lead developer at the SEI. She'd worked with a number of students in the Master of Software Engineering program at the SEI to develop the technique, and they applied it with a variety of different industry organizations. And they built several variations on it for acquisition and other aspects of specific aspects of the engineering process. And they've created some tools to support it. So there's a lot in place for that. And it walks you through these steps and really helps guide you into applying the method.
So this is another example of things that we already know how to do well. It's merely taking the discipline to apply them.
Right. And getting people to adopt them and use them. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Okay. So let's take a look at the risk aspects of security requirements engineering with the SQRE method.
And that leads us to another polling question to help Chris tailor his talk, and that we'd like to know, are you experienced in assessing security risk? Simple yes, no, and we can turn it back to you, Chris, and I'll chime back in with the results in about a couple seconds.
Great. Thanks, Shane. So this method that we developed is a systematic approach for analyzing security risk across the lifecycle. And we're looking at trying to get at some of the complexities of risk, and I'll kind of talk to that in some subsequent slides. What we're looking is to build security into systems, so starting early in the lifecycle. And you can actually recursively apply this at different points in the lifecycle. And so we want to address design weaknesses as early as possible, create requirements for them so we can start to mitigate them, and then ultimately deploy systems with a reduced residual cybersecurity risk.
And to close out our polling real quick, we were at 55% no, not experienced in assessing security risk, and 45% yes.
Okay, so I'm going to go through some of the basics of what we do in the SQRE method. I'm going to start with something that's kind of different that we're trying to incorporate into our risk analysis methods than some of the techniques that we worked on 10 years or so ago. And that's a scenario-based approach. So this picture, I think, kind of gets to that idea. You start with a threat actor, and in fact, we can accommodate scenarios with multiple threat actors, accessing the infrastructure, exploiting weaknesses to target mission data. And you want to do, and the threat actor is trying to achieve some kind of a goal. That's to some adverse outcome related to the data, disclosure of data, modification of data, affecting the availability of data. And so what we're seeing here is that those map to confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Once you do that, the question is, well, what happens then? Well, then we look at how does that affect the mission. So in SQRE, our focus is on mission impact. So we look at workflows, which are the other a synonym for that is mission thread or business process. We map those out, look at where the data affects the business process and just see what might happen. And we use that to help us project the consequences when we're doing the risk analysis. And then those adverse consequences to the outcome can lead to mission degradation or mission failure. And so one of the key aspects in doing these scenarios is to first start out by understanding how the system performs under normal circumstances, identifying what we call the baseline of operational performance. And so that's the first task in the four tasks that we've defined in the CIRA method. First, we understand the operational context, and I'll talk to each of these specifically as we move through the talk. Then we look at identifying the risk scenarios, analyzing them, and then developing control plans. So the other thing I want to point out is all the examples that I'll show here is from a study that we recently completed on the Wireless Emergency Alert Service. And that is WEA, as it's called, is a major component of FEMA's Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, or IPAWS. And so the idea here is that this is getting emergency alerts on your cell phones. So I'm sure a lot of you have had weather alerts and things like that on your phones. And so we did a study to look at some of the risks in this WEA service. Just to walk you through the basic roles, because some of this will come up in subsequent slides, starts out with an initiator. So if we're thinking about a weather alert, the initiator would be a meteorologist, and say that meteorologist says severe weather is going to come through some geographic area, and like the county you're in. That meteorologist will decide, recommend issuing an alert. The alert originator, in this case, the National Weather Service, would send the alert out, but it doesn't go directly to your phone from the National Weather Service. It goes to FEMA, who processes and formats it for the commercial mobile service providers. These are the carriers like Verizon, Sprint, and the other carriers. And then they format it and send it to the technology that they support, and it gets to your cell phones. So that's how they call the WEA pipeline works. And we're going to look at the CMSP, or Commercial Mobile Service Provider, part of that in this talk, and that's what we focused on in the study. You'll notice that there's a footnote here at the bottom of the slide. That's the actual details of the study. I'm just going to be able to skim the surface in this short presentation. If you want the details, you can go to that link. Also, on the materials tab, it's not there now, but tonight we'll add the final report to the tab so that you can access it from there directly as well. So we have in task one, we'll look at three basic steps. Determine system of interest, select the workflow or mission thread, and establish the operational views. So what I mean by operational views is what we want to do is we want to model what's going on in the operations. Now, if you go back to what Chris was talking about in the previous presentation, how they looked and gathered information, they were looking at how do things work. And so what we want to do when we're doing the risk analysis is we start by saying, what is the mission thread? What the system that we're developing, what's it supporting? What business processes?
So would you say the analogy here in this example, these are, I would say, big objects, you know, the mobile carriers and so on. But they have analogs in the Jeep example in where the systems are the subcomponents that Fiat got from various places, whether it was Harman, whether it was Sprint, whether it was the ACUs that are inside there. But again, we have these components, and they're all connected, and together they form some sort of operational context.
Right. And the so the same principles that I'm talking about apply at the system level with the Jeep example, and we're looking at a system of systems level in this example, but the same thinking can be applied. So the other views we look at are things like technology views. Do we know about the system diagrams? Can we look at the architecture network diagrams if they apply? We always like to look at use cases. How do people legitimately use the system? Because that helps us determine how can we abuse the system or misuse the system? What are some of the abuse and misuse cases? We also always look at the data flows, because what we're trying to do is figure out how we can corrupt the data, or how we can find data that we can view or make it unavailable. We may look at physical diagrams like facility layouts if we're looking at cyber physical attacks and things of that nature. So we want to really understand what would the system look like in its operational context. Again, since we're early in the life cycle, there may be some guesswork involved, but we do know some of this information. So I'll show you kind of the thinking of how some of the modeling, we put the modeling together. I talked about the five roles of WEA earlier, and this slide kind of shows you, it's a swim lane diagram. Each lane represents one of the roles. And so we start with the swim lane diagram. Then we look at what systems support each of those activities. So again, as Mark was saying, these are the at a big level, big systems that support a workflow that spans multiple organizations. Now, what you'll see in the top left quadrant, now there's a red dash around a box. That's the CMSP box, so the carriers. And what we do then is we take a look at what's really going inside that box. Let's do a deep dive into that, and we get the detailed workflow. Now, on the same in the same analogy, we look at the system of interest and the system of systems diagram, and we can explode it and look at the details of the architecture. So we're taking, if you look at the top diagrams, that's kind of the 40,000-foot level. The bottom diagrams are more at the 5,000-foot level, and you can dive down to any level of detail that you need to do that you need for the analysis that that you're doing. So this slide shows the a couple of the key data assets, critical data assets that we identified for this study, and then the confidentiality, integrity, and availability goals that were assigned to those assets. And so the idea here now is, if you think back to the step two or activity two of the security requirements engineering, now we know what the asset, key assets are, and we know what's important about them. And so we can move to the next task, which is identifying or starting to elicit and document the risks. So we start with what are the threats, and then based on the threats, we look at the consequences. We then look at what enables each threat to occur, and then what can make the consequences worse, the amplifiers, and then we develop the security risk scenarios. Okay, in this particular example, we looked at four scenarios, and I'm going to focus on the top one, insider sending false alerts. And the what we did here is, or the basic gist of this risk, is that a disgruntled insider decides to plant malicious code into the code base for the CMSP system, and then that will repeatedly send a nonsense message to recipients in a targeted geographic area. So the idea is to annoy people, get them to be angry at the carrier, because this is one way a disgruntled insider might, who has the technical skills, get negative attitudes towards the carrier.
So again, in the Jeep example that Chris and I were considering, we have all these suppliers. You could have a disgruntled employee in one of the suppliers to some of the modules that also may want to do a similar kind of advanced persistent threat or some other kind of malicious activity.
Right, and in fact, in this study, we looked at one of those, and risk three there is actually looking at malicious code in the supply chain. And again, there it was somebody at, because an insider in in the supply chain doing the same type of thing. So exactly, I mean, that's an important piece, and because most of these organizations acquire their systems from external groups. I'm not going to go through the details of this. If you're interested in the details of any of these slides, feel free to look at the report. This is what we do here is we break each thread. I kind of gave you the gist of it a minute ago. We look at a sequence of steps. What does it take to make that happen? Starting with the first step, the insider becomes disgruntled. The last step is the malicious code sends nonsense messages repeatedly. And then for each threat step, we look at one or more enablers, and we define an enabler as a condition or circumstance that facilitates a threat's occurrence or facilitates that step's occurrence. So in this case, when it's sending out messages, you want to know is before the messages actually get sent to the recipients, are they looking and doing any filtering of the content to see if they can pick up anything that's odd or unusual and stop it before it gets sent so they can do a final check? Likewise, then, with consequences, we look at the range of consequences. And on this slide, you see we look at impacts to the our consequences with respect to the recipients, the FEMA, the carriers. And so it starts with people becoming annoyed. They complain to the carrier. In some cases, they may, if the situation gets bad enough, they may decide they want to switch to another carrier. And it may actually cause people to lose trust in the WIA service itself. So there are a lot of various impacts that we look at. And when we look at the impacts, we look at what we call amplifiers. What can make them worse? And then this example here is the geo-targeting capability. That says what area should get this message. Well, if you know how to exploit that, you can actually give it to a broader range of people, and in this case, annoy more people. And so we want to look at that because when we get to the control section, amplifiers and enablers become important as helping us determine how to control the risk. Task three, I'm going to go through this one pretty quickly. For those of you who are not familiar with risk analysis, we use a fairly basic risk analysis, qualitative risk analysis process. For each of the scenarios, we look at what we subjectively estimate what we think the probability is, what the impact might be, and then look at the risk exposure. And that's done as really a feed into task four, where I want to spend the bulk of the rest of the time. So we use those impact probability and risk exposure estimates to rank the scenarios. And we key off of impact because what we want to look is we want to make sure as we consider the catastrophic or rare events where you have a very, very low probability, very high impact, we want to keep those in the mix and consider those as part of the mitigation because a lot of the security breaches that we hear about, you look at them over, just like what Chris was talking about in the last segment, you think about, boy, that's a lot of work. It's highly unlikely somebody would be able to pull something like that off. Like you were saying, it's so complex and it seems like it's hard to do. But a lot of times, the big high impact security attacks are the ones that are hard to do.
Right. And so the thought here is it's not really about a technical argument, can you do something or can't you do something, or even how hard it is, but what's the risk that you're willing to take, and then deciding what's important to focus on versus what might be able to be deferred.
Right. And so we decided that we would mitigate any of the scenarios that we identified that were medium or above, and in this case, all of them fell into that category. So we look at control. So for each enabler and amplifier that we've identified, we identify a control, which is a safeguard or a countermeasure to counteract the enabler or the amplifier. In this case, the control is doing monitoring of the messages for content, and so that you might be able to find some unusual content that's coming through the system. Gather those, and in this case, we came up with 35 high-priority security controls in the 15 areas that you see on this slide. We had administrative areas like human resources and training. We had some physical security controls that we identified, and also technical security controls in a variety of areas. So with this, the idea then, in taking this back now into how we feed this back into the security process, not all of these controls have design implications. Like, for instance, the human resource processes were operational processes and they had nothing to do with the design of the system. Same thing about the training aspects as well. But these three areas, for instance, are examples of controls that had requirements implications. We found that access control was important, so making sure that people were authorized to only look at the information that they had access, that they should have access to based on job responsibility. The system architecture, are there backup communication channels? So if the main communication channel, so in the WIA service, you're sending messages out to the community. If your main communication channel mm-hmm. goes down, do you have a backup? And is it a non-redundant backup so mm-hmm. that you, if there's a denial of service attack, you can mitigate that, that attack? And the technical monitoring, we talked about monitoring the messages, monitoring for right. abnormal activity in the system. These all have implications for requirements. And
so those are common themes, not just for Weir or the Jeep, but understanding your security needs from an authentication authorization who's allowed to do things.
Right.
The whole system reliability that is denial of service as opposed to a particular attack, something that needs to be accommodated. And what are the architectures then to support this? It's not just figuring out some particular kind of security control that goes in there. It's a much larger issue.
Right, right. In most yeah. cases, yes, yes. And so what you're trying to do is input these. So now if you're looking at access control, mm-hmm. you should craft a requirement that says that you need to have features in the system that allow for authorization to certain resources in the system, and that not everybody can have, obviously, access to everything in the system. So you start partitioning who has access to what. And so when you go through the whole list of the controls that come out of the risk assessment, you feed them into the requirements elicitation activity in step four, and now you can start crafting what should be built into the system. And then in step five, in doing the security risk analysis, you've already identified your mitigations or controls to the threats, which links it to the data, and it also is then linked to the security goals, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So you've done a lot of the categorization already. The risk helps you with the prioritization then, mm-hmm. because as you look at the risks, you say which risks are most important, and then you can look at what controls are in place. You start looking at cost-benefit analysis and things of that nature, and then you start to decide and make your choices as to, again, there's a trade-off, right? Performance right. versus security, and cost versus security. And so a lot goes into the trade-off space.
Right. I assume that in these kinds of systems, like and also in cyber-physical systems, this concept of maintenance and authority, the logical equivalent of the system administrator, plays a big role, because we've learned in IT you just shouldn't give the system administrator the ability to do anything anywhere, but we still have a mentality in cyber-physical systems that the mechanic, whoever is working on the system, whether it's in something like WIA, where it might be the carrier or the employee of the carrier who's doing some kind of work, or in the automotive systems, the physical mechanic or the dealer, have unfettered access to everything because they're trustworthy or implied to be trustworthy, and that may not, in fact, match the threat modeling.
Right. And in the threat yeah. modeling, what you want to do is you want to start questioning things and right. say, what if they aren't trustworthy? What happens then? And then you start looking and creating the scenarios. And so that's where you start looking at some of the use cases. Here's mm-hmm. Here's what these people have access to, and here's how they use the system. And then you say, well, how can we abuse that trust that we've put in people? And that can help you start to think about how you want to segment mm-hmm. operational use of the system. And I think we have one more polling question.
Okay. And Chris's final polling question that's going to be posed now is, are your organization's security requirements designed to reduce security risk in deployed software or systems? And while we vote for that one, Chris, do you mind if we get into some questions
sure.
from the audience? So let's see. Ted here wanted to know, is Sarah integrated with regular requirements development for a system, or is it done separately and then integrated later?
Well, it's integrated with the security requirements pieces of the system, which should be part of your requirements, general requirements activities in the organization. And so, in general, if you're doing especially if you're looking at the security generating security requirements, you should be doing some form of risk assessment, whether it's CIRA or some other version. There are lots of risk assessments out there, but you should be doing some aspect of risk analysis, and it should be integrated into what you're doing, and that should also be integrated into your overall requirements process.
Okay. A couple questions again about if the materials are available to download. If you just go to the Download Materials tab at the bottom of your screen, you'll find everything, and the event is being archived, so that will be available by tomorrow. Amy wanted to know, how do you evaluate credibility of each threat? Are insiders with security clearances less likely or more likely to become disgruntled? Is that a question for Randy Trezak?
Yeah, that's actually a good question for our insider threat people. I think what you want to do in terms of when you're doing a risk analysis, I would look at you might look at it from two cases. What a normal a person who has regular access, what could they do? But what could some of the super users or administrator type people do? Because they generally have access to more resources, more information, and they can often do more damage. And so you might want to play it a few different ways. But what I think I would do is defer to what the data from someone like our insider threat team and what they would say where the most likely threats are to occur. I don't have a good answer for that right now.
We'll squeeze one more from Brandon asking, how do you verify that the risk analysis and probabilities are reflective of reality?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Right now, what we're doing is using security expertise to do this and having security experts. And you have multiple experts looking at it from different perspectives. And so it's very subjective right now. And so how can you say it reflects reality? Well, if you have multiple experts looking at it from different perspectives, that's about as good as we see people doing these days. We don't have a lot of data that we can draw on to say that the actual quantitative probability is X or Y. And so that's one of the difficulties and one of the areas I think that's ripe for future research in this area is how do we refine that and improve upon that as we move forward.
Just to wrap up the polling question, which was, are your organization's security requirements designed to reduce security risk in deployed software or systems? It was 69% yes, 9% no, 22% don't know.
Okay.
Back to you for your summary.
Okay, a couple key points. Just want to highlight that the whole focus of what we're looking at here is software assurance, and that has two aspects, predictable execution and trustworthiness. We're focusing here on trustworthiness, and the goal is to have some level of confidence that you're addressing your risks and that your software is trustworthy. In this case, risk is a good way of doing that because if you're looking at what your highest concerns are, that gives you and you're mitigating them, that gives you some level of confidence in the software that you're producing. Second is with respect to software security requirements. Those are features that preserve the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of system data. And we kind of showed you how in the CIRA method, our first task, we look at data flows, we look at what's important about the data from a CIA perspective, and then that kind of helps you get the first step in terms of addressing that aspect of software security requirements. And then by applying the CIRA method, you look at your risks, you prioritize them, you develop controls for the highest priority risks, and then you bring that back into the security requirements engineering process and integrate it back together.
There's another element as well to go back a bit to the last question that we just got. Mm-hmm. Because we just didn't have time to really delve deeply into CIRA, so that we didn't cover everything. But one of the elements of creating the operational context and the threats is to expand the number of views that are considered, physical views, operational views, data flow views, process views, workflow views. And the point there is that in many circumstances, security is done in a very siloed way. So you ask a system administrator what's important, and they'll say configuring the firewall rules. And if that's not done, they say there's a big risk to the system. Once you get everyone to see all of these viewpoints from who's responsible for the physical security of the system and the maintenance and the development and so on, you see all these different views, and people get everybody gets the same comprehensive view, and then the administrator, to sort of pull on this thread, will say, well, that firewall rule really isn't the most important thing to do because now I understand it's in a locked room and no one can get in anyway and there's no outside connectivity, so the firewall is not the real security control that's helping make the system secure. And that's a way to avoid groupthink and silo thinking in trying to make sure that you've got the appropriate security you need in order to accomplish what the business mission is.
Yeah, just to build on that, when you look at the views, the one thing I wanted to point out, there's a lot of, when you look at all the models, it looks like a lot of work, but if you're doing a good job of engineering the system, a lot of those should be available anyways. You should have what your workflows are. You should have a general sense of what the use cases are already, so you're not necessarily generating them for this process, but you're leveraging a lot of information that's already been generated.
Can we squeeze in two more questions? I know we're up against it here, but just good questions. One from Andreas asking, this method, like others, appears very similar to failure mode in effects analysis. What are your recommendations to organizations who are familiar with FMEA and want to adopt this method in the security domain?
Yeah, one of the key differences is you're looking at an active threat, so someone's trying to subvert the system. And a lot of times in failure modes, you're looking at how the failures can occur from a reliability perspective. So you want to make sure that you incorporate how human actors can might engage with the system to try to bring it to create risk.
The sort of soundbite that at least I use is attackers don't obey physics.
Great. Next one, how often should the risk analysis be repeated over time as the system changes?
Yeah, well, and so what you want to do is, if you start it in the requirements, as we're talking about, you'll want to take another look when you get to the architecture and look at what's changed, because when you get to the architecture, you know more. And then as you go through each of the key activities in the development process, revisit it at each point. And then because you're getting... As you move through the life cycle, you're getting more certainty about things. Some things that are more speculative up front, you have a better idea as you move through, and you can make better judgments.
Okay. I think you just answered this one too, but do the steps to derive security requirements change when following an agile methodology?
I don't think so, although I have not applied it with an agile methodology yet, but I don't think that steps would change.
Okay.
We actually have done some work in this area as well, and if you like, we can add that to the resource list.
Okay, great. Chris, out of time. Thank you. Wonderful presentation.
Thanks.
Mark, thanks for your facilitation. We're going to break here till about 2:35 Eastern time. So if you are not going to come back for the second part of today's presentation, make sure you go to that survey tab and fill that information there, as your feedback is always greatly appreciated. And we'll be back at 2:35 Eastern time with Secure Coding Best Practices by Bob Sheila. See you then.